Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where things are going, and we talk about the future. And we're not afraid to take a very unusual view of those matters. We believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, you're just not paying attention. And we believe that something is going to happen. Something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. You know, I missed that intro music and your intro, and I've missed that over the last couple of weeks. I'm glad that we've got the show back up and going again.
You know, you think about the early days of the show when we used to do it the crude way, the difficult way, and we'd sometimes go 2 or 3 months, sometimes five, six months at a time between shows, and here we've gone for the first time in more than a year, 2 weeks, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Was it 2 weeks?
That's right.
It feels
like forever because, you know, we had gotten into this groove where we were, you know, every week without fail, and so... Yeah, it seems like a long absence from the show.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's nice to be back. Nice to be back on the program. So, anything big going on in your life over the last couple of weeks?
Well, nothing as big as what's gone on in your life. You know, I mean, congratulations on the new baby, Phil.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, for those who've followed The Speculist or Facebook or Twitter or just about any place else I could put it. My baby, our baby daughter was born April 10th. Mother and child doing fine. Actually, I can probably you can't pick this up in my mic, but I can hear her screaming in the background even as we speak. So she's probably getting ready for her evening nap. But that was my the main reason for our hiatus for a couple of weeks was I was kind of on paternity leave, and great to have that time to spend with the family, and also now great to be back on Fast Forward Radio. So we've also got our chat host with us this evening, Michael Darling. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Also, congrats on the baby. Couldn't happen to a better man.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you to say. And,
definitely better you than me.
Well, I remember, Stephen, you had told me about some friends who were giving you a hard time about being too old to be a new father. And so
yeah.
I've got a few years on you, I'm afraid. I guess they would really be shocked if they saw that. The interesting thing is, here I am. I've got a daughter in college and a newborn daughter. And, you know, the job never goes away. It just changes significantly over time. You think about all this kind of high maintenance with the particularly my main thing right now is diapers. Okay, that's kind of the thing I'm mostly good for at this point with her. But the Specky kid.
We're talking about the newborn.
Yeah, of course, yes. The older one was home with us over the weekend, and my big job with her is trying to talk her out of going on her trip to Cancun because I don't want her to get swine flu. So, you know, it's always something, right? If it's not one thing, it's another. The job changes, but it certainly never goes away. So, you know, that's something you guys have to look forward to as your boys get older over the years. Things like, well, do I just let them take the trip to Mexico? Do I not worry about that? And I was totally cool about violence at the border, right? When that issue came up, I said, well, I understand. That's like saying, don't go to Miami because there's a gang fight going on in Chicago. You can go to Cancun. But when it's a pandemic, then you kind of go, I don't know, the parent thing kicks in and you start to...
It's a huge unknown. We don't know to what extent it's going to, you know, how big this thing is going to be. So, you know, better safe than sorry, I guess is your point.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to persuade her. And if you're listening, Hannah, that's my last word on the subject. Better safe than sorry. Okay. So anyway, let's get going with our program. Very excited to bring on our guests this evening, one of whom, no stranger to the program. The other one, a would-be no stranger to the program. It just hasn't worked out before. But first, let me introduce Alvis Bridges. He is a media producer, futurist, and entrepreneur with a specialty in evolving communications. He's also the president of Memebox. Alvis, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Hi, Phil. Hi, Stephen and Michael. And Phil, congratulations on your new arrival.
Well, thank you very much. We're pleased to welcome you back to Fast Forward Radio. We had you and a whole crew from Memebox on. When was that, Stephen? That was earlier this year, is that
January.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, and it was I thought one of our livelier programs. A lot of fun talking to everyone, but there was someone missing. Unfortunately, Marissa Vietels was not able to be with us the earlier time we had the Memebox folks on. So I'm very glad for the first time, Marissa, to welcome you to Fast Forward Radio. Marissa is the community manager for Memebox, and welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks so much, Phil, and also for me, congratulations on the big day that happened this past week.
Oh, thank you. All right. Well, we've got a number of topics we want to get into with you guys this evening, but I want to start off with a kind of a combined version of a regular feature that we have in the program. We actually have two regular features on the program, and tonight we're going to combine them into one because we've got a news story that we want to talk briefly about, and I wasn't sure how to classify it. So tonight we're going to do it in a little new program, a little new feature that we like to call
Astounding Science Facts.
Or
sorry about that delay, Phil.
Well, they don't really work that well together, so that's my bad. But it's Astounding Science Fact or Tale of the Paranormal. That's our that's our opening conundrum. And a hat tip to our good friend Harvey for suggesting that we add this feature and that we talk about this story. But I'm going to throw this out here, and then I'm going to just round robin with everybody and ask, is this a Tale of the Paranormal or is this an Astounding Science Fact? Here's the headline, former astronaut, man not alone in the universe. And the story is that Edgar Mitchell, who was an Apollo astronaut, part of the Apollo 14 mission, landed on the moon, asserted Monday that extraterrestrial life exists and that the truth is being concealed by the U.S. and other governments. And he says, our destiny, in my opinion, and we might as well get started with it, is to become part of the planetary community. We should be ready to reach out beyond our planet and beyond our solar system to find out what is really going on out there. Well, hey, you know, just editorial comment, that sounds good to me. I like the idea of being part of the planetary community. Here's the interesting twist. Now, Mitchell grew up in Roswell, New Mexico. That's where he's from, okay? So some residents of his hometown took him aside at one point and said, look, you're a prominent, you know, our favored son, prominent guy from this town. We're going to tell you, we're going to trust you with the truth, and the truth is this thing is real. We really did recover an alien spacecraft. There really were aliens. The government's covering this up. You need to know. You need to look into it. So about 10 years ago, he says he got an appointment at the Pentagon to discuss this information that he had been given by these folks in Roswell, met up with an unnamed admiral from the Joint Chiefs, and the admiral pretty much confirmed the story and said, yes, it's true, aliens, spaceships, the whole thing, and we're going to have to come clean on this one of these days. But now, apparently, sometime later, nothing has ever happened, and now the admiral denies that the whole thing ever occurred. So that's the story in a nutshell. We've got a NASA astronaut, Apollo 14, you would think as sound and regular a guy as you could hope to meet on the planet, saying, yes, Roswell, it's true. aliens are true. There's a community of interplanetary community that we need to join up with. What are we to make of this story? Stephen, I'll start with you. Is that a astounding science fact or a tale of the paranormal?
Well, I suspect that we're not alone in the universe. I also suspect we've never had a visitor. And any evidence that there is life on other planets, maybe some of the evidence we've gotten lately from Mars, things like that. That's about as concrete as we've gotten, as far as messages from outer space or anything else. I think it would be just too big of a secret for anyone to keep, especially something as large as a government. So, I think what we've got here is a case of wanting to believe something and then looking at the evidence in such a way, that you build the case with that, looking at something, you look at certain facts, you see it as evidence even though it really isn't, and you kind of build this house of cards.
Okay, so Edgar Mitchell is engaging in wishful thinking. So
yes.
It is a tale of the paranormal, basically.
That's right. That's how I look
okay.
at it.
All right. Alvis, I'll let you go next. What do you make of this story?
Well, I happen to agree, quite a bit with Stephen's line of thinking there. I think it's incredibly likely that there is extraterrestrial life out there, and that's probably due to the fact that there are a lot of developmental inevitabilities and constraints that we all have to go through, different species in the universe. We all have to learn how to harness starlight. We all have to, learn to develop certain capabilities and manage information. And so I think it's very likely that there's a trajectory that develops life out there, in line with John Smart's Evo Devo Info Universe hypothesis, in keeping with that, I think that it's very unlikely that they've, contacted us, and that any civilization that's complicated enough to crack the speed of light barrier is probably number one no longer a planetary civilization. So we're looking at them in terms of something else like. There are some sort of extropy force in the universe, and that if they have visited us, they certainly haven't done it in little spaceships in humanoid figures.
Have been recovered by the Air Force and hidden away in a freezer in Roswell.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. That's two votes for Tales of the Paranormal. Marissa, what do you got for us on this one?
Yeah, I agree with Alvis. I think I wouldn't want to ever rule out, some insane extraterrestrial reconnaissance work on our planet, but I do think that if there were extraterrestrial beings and wanted to contact us, they wouldn't come in a spaceship, and it just sounds a little bit science fiction to me. And I think it's pretty obvious that it is science fiction.
Yeah, and not necessarily in a good way. Kind of cheesy science fiction almost.
Yeah. Kind of like a bad movie.
All right, so we're tending towards Mitchell's not right here. Michael, you get to be the tiebreaker. You get to go against it and explain from your background as a officer in the United States Air Force the truth. Come clean. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm sure you know one way or another, right, Michael?
Yeah, you should know.
As tempting as it would be to go down the path of contrariness here, hooey.
Okay, well everybody's saying no, huh? Well, I'm going to have to agree too. All points well made. Actually, this takes us back to we did a tale of paranormal. It's probably been more than a year ago about a big flap of UFO sightings. I'm trying to remember. Was it called Stephenville, Texas? Is that right? That's right. Yeah, Stephenville, Texas, and. This was where I developed the theory that the aliens are either not there or they're stupid. Okay, and these would be the stupid aliens. I have to go back to my original breakdown of what it is the aliens want. Okay, either they want us to know about them, or they don't want us to know about them. if they want us to know about them, they're going about it all wrong, right? I would think.
Yeah, you land in Times Square, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you don't just have one ship crash. You put on the big show. Land. In fact, forget Times Square. I'm saying now right in front of Mandalay Bay in Vegas, because everybody's got a camera and it would look very cool. But but yeah, either they want to be seen or they don't want to be seen. The point being, and going back to what Alvis, you and Marissa had to say, you know, anyone who had that level of technology, if they wanted us to be part of their interplanetary community, there's no way the U.S. government could cover it up. There's no way that any force on Earth could hide us from these beings. So, I'm going to have to side with everyone else. But it's interesting to pose what's going on here with Edgar Mitchell. This was what led me to this, because when Harvey had sent me this story, I said, so why are you sending me this? Do you want it to be a tale of the paranormal or an astounding science fact? And he wrote back and he said, well, probably a tale of the paranormal. His theory was that maybe Mitchell had taken in a few too many G-forces on the old cyclotron at some point, and maybe it had finally caught up with him. My wife actually suggested, I thought this was not terribly charitable, that maybe we have to add a third feature to the program, something we might call Ramblings of a Crazy Old Guy. But I don't think that's a good treatment of a American hero like Edgar Mitchell. So I'm going to say, well, what is actually going on here? And I think what's going on here is, tying it into other topics we're going to be getting into, is the kind of relentlessness of the Roswell meme, and maybe of the UFO meme overall, that here is an idea that reproduces itself and that gets a hold of people in a very, I don't know, I keep coming back to the word relentless way.
Visceral.
I'm sorry, Alvis, go ahead.
A very visceral kind of way, relatable way.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, people really relate to this story. They want it to be true. They very much want it to be true. And I think even somebody trained to be objective, trained in engineering the way Mitchell was, this is a cautionary tale for all of us, that he could be approached by people in his hometown, which probably would immediately have something to do with, well, there's huge credibility to, like, you know, the senior members of your community bring you to one side and say, hey, we've got this thing going on in our community that somebody needs to deal with. And there is a trail of evidence that you can pick up and say, oh, yes, look, it's real, it's all true, if you buy into it, right? If the meme gets a hold of you, it gets you. So I think this is a very interesting example of the Roswell meme, of the UFO meme, and also of conspiracy memes and just how powerful they are. Because, Stephen, to your point, this would be an awfully big thing to keep covered up, really.
Yeah.
Even as ineptly as apparently they have kept it covered up, considering how many people are talking about it all these years. But it should have been blown wide open by now if it were true. It's just kind of like the JFK conspiracy theories or these 9/11 conspiracy theories. These things are really too big to have ever been pulled off. But
exactly the opposite of trying to keep it covered up. I think there may have been a point in the Cold War where the government might have pushed these rumors.
Explain. Why would they have done that?
Well, I mean, what would freak out the Soviets more, you know, than if the meme got started in their culture that the U.S. has alien technology, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, that would have been a very scary thing.
Yeah, we ought to just give up and become capitalists, you know? I mean,
well, it's widely known.
Not
that
even just give up. Not even just give up. I mean, you know. It's like the Star Wars program. You just get them to spend more money and throw more money at paranormal stuff and win the budget wars.
That's right. That's right.
Exactly.
Get them to throw stuff that's never going to amount to anything, like, you know, telekinesis research and things like that, yeah.
Or UFOs. And it was known and has been revealed in greater detail since then that they were very much interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that if anything, the government probably helped create this ongoing legend and helped create a situation where somebody like Edgar Mitchell would step up and say this, because they probably threw some disinformation out there and probably took something that happened originally that was a little weird, and there was a news story, and suddenly there was some hysteria around it. They took that, spun it a little bit to see if they could get some traction with the Russians, and first thing you know, it's, what, 60 years later, and the story has only grown, and it seems to be attracting new believers every day.
It's a whole mythology.
Fascinating in so many ways, just to see, you know, that is one example of, you know, one of these, you know, I remember discussing with you the first time we met, meme wars, and in general how ideas spread, and yeah, this is a great example of just how powerful ideas can be, and they can really, I mean, you've seen some of these people on TV, the UFO believers, they're just, it's almost cult-like, they're so wrought with belief in this idea, in this meme, so just a good example there.
Yeah, it really does get a hold of them,
The thing is, there really are secrets that are being kept from us, and there's really an Area 51, and they're really testing aircraft that they don't want the public to know about. But yeah, I mean, all these things are probably, you know, are true, and you just, you know, and for a conspiracy-minded person, it's easy to add another layer on top of that.
Right. Yeah, you build a layer on top of reality. That's what happens, and I think that's exactly what happened here. Well, let me just say, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about memes, and we're going to start talking a little bit about a particular meme that we're interested in spreading, kind of the opposite of the UFO meme. This is the good one, the true one, the singularity. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we do have a lively online chat, or you can leave your comments at blog.speculist.com. So let's get into this. Marissa, you mentioned that when we first met, we were talking about meme warfare, and this is actually a good example of the, if I were to describe myself as being a meme warrior, I guess the UFO meme is one that I fight against, and then there's one that I'm really strongly in favor of. Actually, there are quite a few that I'm strongly in favor of. The one we want to talk about this evening is the singularity, and spend some time talking about how we get that one out. How do we get traction with this idea? And maybe before we do that, it would be a good idea to step back and say what we mean by the singularity, just as a quick reminder to those listening or anyone who's new to the subject, and then talk about why we think it's important to spread that idea. So Marissa, Alvis, either one of you, I'll just give me the quick, what do we mean by the singularity?
Well, you know, I'll jump in here and take that one. There are multiple definitions of the singularity, ranging from, you know, it's a once-in-a Earth lifetime event, one event that's impossible to go back from. It's something that the human species can't quite wrap our minds around. And on the flip side of that is the belief that all sorts of systems and subsystems undergo singularities at certain points, and that there are these kind of developmental little tornadoes that create events all around us. You know, I personally, while I'm a huge subscriber of the accelerating change meme and, you know, a lot of the fundamental hardware predictions that Ray Kurzweil is making, you know, I do find the singularity term a little bit problematic in that it does have these different definitions that, you know, when this meme is unleashed in conversation, some people often mean one thing, and others hear something else, and some people mean something else.
And just to jump in for a second, it's important, especially, you know, today when we're hearing talk of, we don't have to necessarily go into this, but Singularity University, we call a university something that is in an effort to have a full understanding of the future and singularity in that sense. I mean, it's pretty important to get the definition right, but Elvis, you can finish your thought.
Yeah, so while I think it's a great meme to have out there, and it certainly reinforces a lot of accelerating change, I think that the singularity meme is also an example of a meme that can close off the pathway to thinking about or simulating other futures. You know, if you are a diehard believer in an inevitable singularity, you know, for example, that's born out of strong AI or AGI, then a lot of other futures, some, you know, very quickly become not as palatable and, you know, not as integral to your simulation. So I think I think it's fascinating meme in that regard. You know, it's seeing tremendous adoption. You know, I think we're about to live through a tipping point of the singularity meme and of the accelerating change meme. And I just hope that, you know, as that occurs, that we strive to continue to, once again to refer to John Smart, to stem compress and to find the most elegant, word and pair that meaning to make sure that, when we're having a good conversation that we're all meaning the same thing.
Alvis, you said tipping point. You're not talking about the singularity itself. You're talking about maybe a point of no return?
Yeah, well, when I say tipping point now, I just mean tipping point in the diffusion of the meme of the singularity.
Oh, okay.
But in the context of, one version of the singularity can be, a point, of no return, past which we evolve and think about, life in such a different way in which we have such amplified intelligence, or we have, an AGI processor running that we just can't understand.
Well, let's step back. I'm intrigued by the distinction that you've made between the accelerating change meme and the singularity meme. And granted, I recognize that they're different. Although, if you follow the breakdown that I think Eliezer Yudkowsky has given of the three major definitions of the singularity, accelerating change is seen as one of them. But would you describe an accelerating change meme or a set of ideas around accelerating change that are independent from the singularity? In your view, does accelerating change culminate in the singularity, or is that not necessarily the case?
In my view, a strong AGI singularity, in other words, in which we get AI in a box that is so revolutionary that it replicates and essentially does our thinking for us, I think that's the one scenario of the singularity that I can see as being very, very plausible. In the context of what else I think is possible for the future, I don't know, maybe I give it a 5% or a 10% chance, but I think that accelerating change and systems convergence and acceleration that builds on other acceleration, I think that's a much safer bet. So I do distinguish the two.
I'd like to jump on that too, Phil.
Go ahead.
My thought is that most people sense the accelerating change. People, they see the headlines. They understand things are getting crazy as far as the amount of development on a day by day basis. But they might not have taken the next step in their thinking to, what does this mean ultimately? And
right.
Where does this carry us? And the singularity is one possible destination.
Well, and I think the other part of that is that although people are in a vague way or maybe in a detached way aware of the fact that that technological progress is occurring and even that the rate of progress is speeding up, I'm not sure that the implications of that become very clear to people, and I'm not sure that the scope of what's actually possible presents itself to them. I think that people tend to view the world as being a lot more static than it actually is, and I think that the kinds of changes that we're in for are not changes that people are not expecting, they're not even contending with them. One of the things that led us to having this topic on our agenda for this evening was Michael Darling had written a post on The Speculist about the topic of life extension being discussed on Oprah. And Michael, why don't you say a couple words about that?
Well, two things. One, the not that I wouldn't watch Oprah, but I don't generally watch Oprah, which I explained in that post, but that I noticed it because I was doing something else on the web, and I got a banner ad for the doctor that does the medical stuff when Oprah turns to her, resident medical guest, Dr. Oz, and it was an ad for resveratrol, and I clicked on the banner ad to see what was up with Dr. Oz and him talking about life extension, and it turns out that Oprah has done at least 2 shows on life extension and is planning to do more with Dr. Oz, trying to explore the both conceptually and maybe the state of the art of what's out there and what people are doing to try to distinguish quackery from actual what we would call real medical science. And I just thought it was interesting. I was like, well, next thing you know, Oprah's going to be talking about robot overlords.
Or space elevator. How go ahead, Marissa.
I was going to say quickly, if it's anything like Oprah's effect on Twitter adoption, then we're in for a crazy treat with the practical life extension. I don't know if you guys heard about that and a few in the past. I'm not sure when it was exactly, but
I think it was just last week.
Tell us about it, Marissa.
Yeah, no. Well, I don't really know the whole story myself, but I just know that all of a sudden, the past week, I use Twitter for, you know, on and off, but the past week, all of my friends from, you know, were never interested in technology, and they're, you know, were kind of Facebook users, but not really anything else. All of a sudden, they're like, oh, so-and-so added you on, is following you on Twitter. So I'm like, what? What are all these people doing on Twitter all of a sudden? And then I realized, oh, it's because Oprah, I'm not sure, did she make a comment about it, or did she promote it, or did she say that it was fun, perhaps, but it's just funny, like, you have these certain people with so much power to change the effect, the adoption of a certain technology or over a certain meme, and that's...
Well, what I understand, I didn't see the show, but what I understand is she actually, you know, had some computer expert next to her, and she logged on and twittered in front of the entire audience and everything, showed the audience how to do it. And her first Twitter was something like, some movie star is on next, whoever that person was, and that was her first Twitter. And anyway, that, like you say, that was definitely a moment for the Twitter people, wasn't it?
That's really interesting. You have this kind of one person tipping point herself in Oprah. And I just want to swing it back long enough, Michael, to say it's okay with us if you watch Oprah, okay?
That's good.
Yeah, whatever you want to watch is fine with us. But that kind of swings it all the way back, Marissa, to the conversation we had at the conference about my initial question, which was, what would it take to get the folks who watch Dancing with the Stars or American Idol or Monday Night Football to start engaging some of these possibilities, to start thinking about these possibilities? And the show I didn't think to mention is the one that I should have mentioned, the people who watch Oprah. Well, what it takes is for Oprah to start talking about this stuff, and it seems that really opens things up. She's kind of a one-woman meme machine. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? What do we think of that?
She's surely a one-woman kind of functionally equilibrium in the sense of Twitter's adoption. But I think a lot of these things you can't really control. I think the strength of memes is something that it can change with the wind and it's hard to comprehend. I mean, I think in terms of Twitter, it doesn't really matter. It's a cool tool. I mean, cool. It's great that more people are using it, and maybe that allows them to understand group dynamics in a better sense or connect with their friends on a better level in microblogging and things like that. Great. In terms of like a life extension, I think any kind of attention given to radical life extension or accelerating change is great and is due because it's one of the topics that I personally think, this is a few of the topics that I personally think are deserve to be more in the limelight than they have been in the past. So any kind of progression there is great with me. But everyone has a different opinion. I mean, there are people, I'm sure, who maybe more on the religious side or more on the traditional side, who maybe would say, you know what, that's not great. You know, I don't even want my kid to hear about the Methuselah Foundation or what they're up to, you know, or things like that. So everyone's going to have a different opinion. Everyone's going to have a different meme set that they would like to portray or to spread through society. So I think it's just really an individual thing.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that there are a number of these different possible threads that can be picked up, and it was not by accident that the original post was on life extension, but that I made the topic of the program tonight, the singularity. And Alvis, taking it back to your point, maybe that's a reason that the kind of overarching idea of accelerating change might be a more fruitful way to disseminate some of these ideas. The singularity tends to be kind of a monolithic idea. I mean, it's this: you reach this point of greater than human intelligence, and then you don't know what happens next. It's this big dividing line in human history. But there are a number of other topics related to it, or related to accelerating change, that would be potentially of interest. And life extension is one of those, and a lot of the other kinds of technologies and trends that we talk about here, that you talk about on Future Blogger, are probably also good examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, just because I put, I give the singularity a lower than 100% chance of occurring doesn't mean I also think it's not a good meme to put out there. I mean, I still think that it succeeds in opening people's eyes to accelerating change, because it's so dependent on that term. There's a lot of other stuff. The Gaian hypothesis, planetary intelligence, social intelligence, extreme versions of all these things. I think the idea of extreme convergence is a good meme to put out there. Extreme convergence and acceleration, just those kind of first pair to paint that idea into the minds of those listening to those memes.
And let's take you up on that one. Let's say we want to start getting that idea out there, introduce that idea to a broader audience, other than publishing a website such as Future Blogger or The Speculist. What are the kinds of things we might do to encourage awareness, to encourage people to learn about this, and to understand that kind of convergence, that these possibilities are really just around the corner?
Well, I think that the starting block is using whatever basic technology, communication technology we have at our disposal to communicate those ideas most effectively. And throughout history, we've developed newer and better ways of getting information across. And now we're getting into simulations, abstract visuals, charts, things like that. So I think that I remember a discussion that I participated in with a guy from the International Skeptics Society, and we were having a back and forth about, okay, there's a lot of bad information out there. Sturgeon's Law, says that there's 95% of information is redundant crap, so how do we fight that? And this guy's like, okay, well, you fight bad words with good words. And I think that over time, especially when we're all pinched for time in an accelerating world, I think that just doesn't hold up. I think you need to show linkages of frameworks. You need to come up with new ways to show accelerating change visually, by showing maps of like how quickly biological epochs, how quickly we transition it, to show that there's a clear buildup, to show that there's a universal arc to all this stuff, to show the timelines of products that are just so kind of mind-blowing. Like if you look at a timeline of computer chips or portable devices over the last 5 or 10 years, it's amazing that we just don't have the attention span to be able to look at all these convergences around us. So I think, rather than wanting to read more or encountering people who talk well about that, which I think is important, I think getting at very easy to digest visualizations of these phenomena is critical.
I think
You think about the I'm sorry, go ahead, Marissa.
Okay. I think also some of the semantic web technologies that are coming out right now they're, I think, in my opinion, they're still pretty weak, but they're making great progress in, in that sense, Web 3.0 technology, like as people like to call it. But those just also taking the information from where it is and connecting it. And I think that's where semantic web apps are really going to come in and show a lot of use. Okay, so Phil Bauermaster over here is talking about the singularity. Alvis is over here. You know, all these people, John Smart saying this, Eliezer Yukowski saying this, and kind of bringing everyone together through all these different web apps is going to be really cool as well, like your Twine or your, you know, these kind of applications also. Threading the information together to make more of a storyline that people can follow, as well as I think that paired with the visualization technologies that we are kind of starting to have and able to, you know, show people in a picture and in a storyline. I think those two things are really important in getting into people's brains and seeing like, oh my gosh, so, oh yeah, I guess it's not just I get a new cell phone twice a year now instead of once a year. It's, you know, it's a lot bigger than that.
Yeah, so just visualization over time.
Right. Well, I think about when you hear a typical if you've ever gotten to watch or listen to Ray Kurzweil give one of his talks, and all the slides you see that have the hockey stick chart. You know, he's got so many pictures of. Well, here's another one that's just, you know, the trend line is going vertical, and that image in your mind of you know, things have progressed at a certain pace, and now suddenly we've turned the corner, and things are progressing at a completely different rate. That things are happening in a completely different way. It's one thing for me to say that verbally. It's another thing to have that picture in your head, and that one has become kind of iconic. I know John Smart uses that as the sort of the logo for the Accelerating Studies Foundation. Is you just have this. This line kind of going off into infinity. It suddenly it goes straight up. But
yeah,
I think
just imagine
that
if you're a kid and you come across, you know, the words exponential, you know, convergent developmental, you know, progress versus seeing a chart like that and like that's how fast it's going to go.
Exactly.
So.
So what kinds of pictures? Step me through some of the other pictures or some of the other ways we can visualize this or some of the tools that might be put into place that could help us to visualize this. And then, Marissa, you can pick up on that and tell us how social media and the semantic web are going to help to disseminate those.
Well, two of my favorite tools, you know, one of them is timelines. And the other one is that I like to refer to is, you know, rooted in the semantic web research, but let's just say Wolfram Alpha, which you guys may or may not have heard about, which is about to hit the market, which is actual quantitative search. So Google recently released product timelines and search timelines that allow you to look at the search results, you know, like the timetables of history. It just goes back. I can type in Latvia. I'm a proud to be a Latvian, by the way. Shout out to my Latvian folks. And see essentially a history of Latvia as seen through the eyes of Google. You know, I could pair that then with some quantitative, you know, quantitative search on this new search engine. I could ask it, for example, what's the population of Latvia, and then see that displayed over a timeline. So information meeting timelines to me is a very powerful duo, and it kind of gets at one of my pet ideas, which was a founding perspective for the whole meme box concept, and it's what I call the idea of a tunnel of time. You know, it's creating a timeline in your brain and then pegging certain data or certain simulations to certain years or certain months or certain days in that timeline. I think the ability to navigate that would certainly be, you know, a very valuable tool for learning history and then also for considering diverse future scenarios.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things I like about the tunnel model is it's if you start putting that kind of picture in place, you start thinking not only about the events or the developments and the time frames, but the dependencies between them, right? So if you're looking for, you know, say, when do we get the space elevator? One of my favorites. I always love throwing that one out there. Well, then, if you're trying to identify that on your tunnel going forward, you're going to want to have figured out when we're going to be able to achieve carbon nanotubes of a certain length, right? And various other developments in nanotechnology and various other developments in other material science and other things that have to happen. So it's a great way to kind of move forward and backward between things that you anticipate happening, things that you'd like to see happen, and what really needs to fall into place in order to make that happen. Is that part of the tunnel as you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I would, call those contingency paths toward, a different set of futures, a different set of complex futures. And, that's exactly what I would love to see. I would love to see Eliezer's, singularity contingency path visualized. And then I would like to see, how that compares to people of different, backgrounds and personalities, and how that compares to the modules that, I have high confidence in occurring at certain, points prior to the singularity or out into the future. I think such a device is, I think to take it a step further, I think that's already how we think, because cognitively people have shown that, when you imagine a building, for example, you don't have the full picture in your mind, but you have an idea of what window is. You know that that buildings have roof, gutter, window, side. And you create very quickly, you pull these sub-simulations and you assemble a kind of best-of simulation. And I think, because that's the basis of thought, I think we're going to build out such scaffolding, that helps make us all smarter and able to more intelligently discuss complex variable futures.
It's kind of like hacking someone's brain. Being able to jump in there and say, okay, well, where are you really coming from? What are you actually seeing? What are you too afraid to tell me that you're seeing? In some senses, I think a lot of people are, especially when you talk about, the field of future and futurism and futures and complex futures, everyone has a different idea in their head, although certain ideas maybe overlap. But, really, it's pretty ballsy to come out and say, okay, well, I think this, exactly. That's why people making predictions is so important but it's scary. You really have to put yourself out on the line. But I think it would benefit the entire group if we all had a tool to do so.
Yeah, to compare our contingencies.
I was just going to say, that's an excellent point. The you really have to put it out there when you make a prediction. Particularly if you see it a little bit differently than others, or if you're the first one to predict something in a particular area, right? Suddenly you're kind of there's risk involved in that, isn't there, in being someone who makes a prediction?
That's right.
Absolutely.
I was going to say ego risk.
Yeah.
And professional risk too. I mean, a lot of the folks that we know in the futures field are professional futurists, and they have a reputation at stake, and if their reputation takes a hit, just like someone trying to sell something on eBay, you're all of a sudden like you made a really bad call on Twitter saying that it was the dumbest thing in the world. I don't see it ever getting adoption. That's gonna hurt your next speaking gigs and getting called into all these think tanks and workshops and so forth, book deals.
But what's interesting about that is it really doesn't seem to work that way, at least not. I don't know about specifically for those who predict the future as the future, but those who make predictions about the stock market who get it wrong all the time, or those who make right in any number of different kinds of predictions. You saw these experts who said that gas was going to go to $8, and then they said maybe it's going to go as low as 50 cents. That in fact, the way it really works in the world is you gain reputation by making predictions, apparently irrespective of whether they're correct or not. So although people have this fear of being wrong, apparently just putting a stake in the sand and saying, I think this is going to happen, gives you some air of credibility irrespective of the result. Am I being too glib, or is there something to that?
No, I think there's absolutely something to that, and I think that's a lot of that's rooted in the way that we view authority. If a certain person comes across authoritatively, such as a researcher in a lab coat telling you to shock people in the Stanford or Yale shock experiment back in the day, a lot of people are going to buy into it because not everyone has the critical acumen or the knowledge set at hand, you know, ready at hand to, you know, critique those effectively, that body of, you know, simulation, whatever that person's running. But I do think that a lot of these folks are going to be in for a little bit of a rude awakening once, you know, semantic technology archives, you know, scurries through all of their web history, all their, you know, printed prediction history, all that stuff is digitized eventually. You know, it's going to catch up to them. There's going to be a visual, prediction timeline, and people will see how often their publicly stated statements were proven true or false, and you'll get these scores. Like, I think it's an example of us, you know, where we're not yet, but where we're going to be very soon, and that's a way of getting around the, you know, like, I talk in words, you talk in words, you know, like, we only have a certain amount of bandwidth for words, so a lot of the other people kind of won't figure out what's going on. I think that technology and the global brain is working its way around that problem.
Right. Stephen, I think I stepped on you just a minute ago. Did you have something you wanted to add on this?
Well, if I did, Phil, I've lost it. So, yeah. Anyway, we'll work it back into the conversation in just a minute.
Okay, great. I just didn't want to lose the idea. Well, okay. So let's take this tunnel, and now let's move that from an individual project, which I think is good for all the reasons we just stated. You get skin in the game if you put your tunnel out there, if you put your predictions out there, your ideas about what's going to happen. But what about I'll address this question to you, Marissa. What about a wiki tunnel? Okay. What about a group created tunnel where a lot of different people are weighing in on some of the same possible things?
Yeah, I think some of the technologies that we have available now can be used to do some of this stuff. I think that's what one of Meanbox's goals is, you know, to provide an outlet or a portal for people to come together and share ideas and promote their own thinking and their own blogs and promote their own future-focused information and their own simulations. I know some people who are working on wikis that are doing future-focused wikis that are kind of coming together or starting to, or, Futurepedias, or some people calling it. But I think it's bigger than that. It's a topic that, you know, that can be, it kind of gets muddled in the current technologies that we have at our hand today. I think right now it's still pretty hard to put all those pieces together to make a cohesive portal or cohesive idea set. And also, you maybe you don't even want that either, because you want a group dynamic. You want it to, a community to be based on a variety of different perspectives. But in terms of the technology's sake and how social media and how what we have at our hand today, you can help that. I think it still has a ways to go. But there are people doing great things. And you know, for example, you guys at the Speculus, like, having a pool there, even if it's just a blog, you know, some people are just blogging. I think all the tools today are definitely have made a big step in that goal of furthering this kind of information.
Yeah, it kind of gets it out there. But is anybody doing, or do you think there would be a value in doing something like there's just this one timeline that everyone's contributing to, right? And it would almost, the way I'm picturing it, it would work kind of the way these prediction markets do. So as people weigh in on particular events, particular outcomes, the time frame by which those occur, those would either gain or lose credibility or prominence on that timeline. Is anybody doing anything quite like that, or have I just come up with a new idea here?
No, actually. You know, that's one of the ideas that was also at the root of the meme box experiment, you know, that we hope to get to over time. It turns out that, you know, number one, the complexity of a futures market, you know, there are like 30 or 40 huge
different
ones out there in the world, you know, ranging from like HubSpot, Predictify, InTrade, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and they're all very basic. They're, you know, rule number one is create a binary prediction that's falsifiable. You know, and then some of them are getting a little more complex. You know, they're getting into the, they're adding feedback into the loop from which of our users are the highest rated users. You know, therefore, like, you know, our stock picker algorithm is going to, you know, weight these guys more heavily. But no one's really gotten into the critical dependencies, you know, kind of future chart where, you know, there are like 2,507 contingencies that will lead up to this, you know, this event occurring. You know, like 100 of them are particularly critical and they're weighted as such. And then, you know, you see these clouds that are expandable and contractible. I think up until just a few years ago or maybe now, software was not able to deal with that. Simply to deal with, you know, that huge amount of information and crunching. I think that, you know, it's an example of a technology that follows the need rather than, you know, than leads the need, because it is incredibly complex. But on the flip side of that, Phil, is the idea that we're already dumping so much information about the future and our perspective on the future and our personalities into the web that,
right.
Rather than somebody successfully building one of these from the top down, what this really may be is, you know, like Google search with a timeline 4 years from now. You know, like that way Google can scour the entire web and pull from the millions of hit results that are relevant to yours in a way that's maybe combined with, you know, a quantitative search like Wolfram Alpha and, you know, pick the ones that with the right, you know, semantics, the right, you know, phrasing, you know, retroactively figure out all of these contingency charts and then build something for you. You know, so
okay, so I would get my navigable timeline, but it's going to be created not out of people voluntarily going in and saying, here, I'm going to contribute to this thing. Rather, we've all been contributing to it all along. We've been writing 6 years worth of stuff on Speculist and everyone else who's doing their bit in other places, and all of that gets summed up into an environment that you could navigate and work through and view those relationships. Is that the idea?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is definitely going to happen, and that's going to be a huge part of the process. You know, is inputting all this past data and quantifying what's already been done. I mean, that said, I think that humans will be able to help top down, but it's just in a very limited way due to our lack of attentional, you know, allocation ability. You know, for example, I read a really cool article on FutureScanner about the future of the hashtag. And a hashtag, you know, right now on Twitter is simply, you know, you have your Twitter feed, and whenever you enter a Twitter, you put number sign, the words skate park, Long Beach, and that all goes into a bin, you know, of Twitterers or of tweets, to use the proper term, emanating from, you know, a skate park in Long Beach where there's something interesting going on. So you know, in that from that sense, people, I think there will be researchers going out there and grabbing lumps of data and converting them, you know, helping them along the way, making them potentially a little more machine readable. If it's, you know, if it hasn't already been done, and that might be a new type of business model, you know, for smaller companies, you know, when Google is the supreme organizer of absolutely everything, you know, 4 or 5 years from now.
I'm trying to picture how this would work. Let's say I'd make a search like this, and it assembles something for me. I mean, I'd be able to go, I'd be able to look at this maybe three-dimensionally or whatever, or two, you know, and if there's some event that doesn't take place by a certain date, I could push it out in 6 months or a year or however long I think it's going to take, and how that affects other things. I mean, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I would say that maybe, you know, you have your critical contingencies are all one color, you know, or
okay.
They're brighter, you know, and then, yeah, you have this just massive timeline with lots of links on it, and then all of a sudden, some news comes out, and 95% of the people who believed, you know, that this event, you know, that were factored into the prediction for a certain event, you know, that this was going to take place 6 months from now, all of a sudden they change their opinion. you know, that critical event all of a sudden moves. You get an alert saying that one of your critical future events moved, and this is, you know, something that you've tagged as always notify me when that happens.
Yeah.
You know, and then
A critical event like a robot coming up with its own hypothesis, testing it, and making a discovery, like that happened like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
that's a pretty critical event. So yeah, okay.
I think the bigger idea here is just, and this is a very specific, example of all this, you know, how it relates to futures. But in general, I think just quantification and retroquantification and how that, I think that's the larger point, is that things are going to get quantified to the point where we'll be able to go back and say, hey, you were right, you know, and you said this 5 years ago and you said this yesterday, and look at this timeline and look at how people's ideas swayed from one to the other because of Oprah, and just in general being able to quantify information is going to allow us to identify with it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, the scores that we're going to be able to assign to individuals making these predictions, that's going to be interesting too. We're going to find out how wishy-washy are we about stuff, how influenceable by peer groups, all that kind of stuff. It's going to get nasty.
Well, and I wonder if there's something in addition to wishy-washiness at work, which is there's an issue beyond just dependencies. Isn't there a very real need to deal with alternatives? That for a lot of these potential outcomes, it could be one thing or it could be another. I mean, we actually don't have a good way of saying. I know there's a strong desire to predict or to forecast the thing that's going to happen, but maybe it's just as valuable in some instances, or at least at some stage of the game, to be able to say, well, it will probably not be this one, but it might be this one or that one, and this other one is kind of an outlier. I know when we have Brian Wong on the program, we often get to talking about energy, and he'll throw out, he's just got this exhaustive knowledge of what's happening in energy, and he'll talk about,
yeah, that
well,
guy has serious
we might see nuclear fusion.
I think greater than human intelligence has already been achieved in Brian Wong.
Yeah, you just go to nextbigfuture.com. It's happening. But he'll say fusion is one possibility. Well, here's another kind of nuclear fission. Well, here's yet another different kind of nuclear fission. Here's an outlier blacklight which might occur, and here are things that are less likely. So what about that idea just of not necessarily knowing the outcome, but kind of narrowing the field to the correct alternatives and saying it'll probably be one of these two things? Does that factor in as well, do you think?
I mean, I think that's actually the whole ballgame. You know, I think that I think that when people get into accelerating change and singularity, you know, it's easier to deal with fewer variables, and therefore I think that's why the singularity meme is powerful and it is important, because okay, you know, stuff is moving really fast. Here's a potential, you know, developmental endpoint for this that's on this crazy arc. You know, okay, now we can backtrack and start filling out the rest of the possible futures. And that's when you get into serious futurism and what, you know, everyone's taught at these masters and PhD programs is that always call it futures studies with an S. There is no one future. If you talk like that, you will never get a job in this industry. You know, but that's because,
right.
You know, because it's very, you know, we have the tendency to want to make, you know, definitive futures, you know, and to simulate those in our brains, and it's maddening to try to hold too much information, but the reality is that, you know, the futures, especially in a world of convergent accelerating change, the futures ahead of us, there's so much combinatorial possibility that it's insane. I mean, when Jeff Hilford and I sat down to start writing a book on the, you know, a futurism for dummies that, you know, expanded into a social media portal from, you know, called Memebox, you know, a lot of that was because, Jesus, the variables are immense in here. You know, we could have 35 primary topics, we could have, you know, 3,000 subtopics, and in each of those we could be making thousands and thousands and millions of predictions. And, you know, realizing that is the case, and that people label them all differently, and that people have completely different perspectives, like we're all kind of probes, you know, probing our different area of space-time on Earth with selective, you know, imagination and selective, you know, kind of choices as far as what we're into and what interests us. We do a great job together en masse dealing with making collective futures decisions, but we still have to figure out how to effectively translate that to the web, and the tools that we have at our disposal so far are very, very kind of basic first stab at that are going to need to be combined with a lot of different evolving technologies in order to get, you know, what you refer to as, you know, like this cloud of possibilities that's ahead of us, rather than these concrete, you know, easy, you know, concrete, discrete, easy to process individual futures. I think that's the, you know, the tunnel of time, whenever that pops out into, you know, existence, is going to be massively variable.
Right. Well, let's nail it down here just a little bit. So, switching to definitely trying to forecast and trying to make a prediction, sort of a mode. When do you think we'll have this? When will the search technology evolve to the point, and or from the bottom up, will we have developed the capability that will give us the kind of richly interactive timeline of the past and the present and the future that that people can interact with, and I think really get a feel for accelerating change.
So timelining the tunnel of time, it's like violating like a rule of space time. Like, as soon as I speak, these predictions were all going to just, you know, explode or start fading like Marty McFly.
Yeah, well, do not end the universe, but try your best without ending the universe.
All right, without ending the universe, I think it's going to, you know, my safe, you know, cover my own ass bet is it's going to happen very gradually. But I think, you know, I think just a few years from now, I think we can expect Google to add future timelining to its suite of applications probably in about 2 or 3 years. I think that in about 4 or 5 years, it's going to be very common to run future and past searches, and then to be able to run an accompanying visual search or video search that gives you vignettes pertinent to that time, to that future or that past. You know, so imagine the utility, for example, if you're working on a historical documentary or some kind of TV program, or if you're a researcher, you know, putting together a futures document for some organization. You know, search, have visuals, boom. You know, like I have a ton of options there. Right there, that's decreased the amount of time that it takes me to gather information, to create a bunch of simulations that are feasible, more or less, and to then, you know, sprinkle them out. You know, full scale, like 3D integrated tunnel of time, probably, I would say 2015 to 2020. You know, there will be some crude, search. I wouldn't say crude, but all these evolving, you know, search technologies for visual, you know, semantic, quantitative, they're all going to come together, and then there's going to be some AI that stitches them together in a tunnel fashion. And I think people will start developing like beta versions of that probably around, you know, so they'll probably start in 2013 and be, you know, have stuff that's crude hitting the market 2016, 17, 18, I would guess.
I was wondering, maybe I could pose this to the group, how the economy and, you know, the economic downturn that we've seen all over the world, how that would affect, you know, the progression of technology like this, web technologies. I mean, I think in some sense, in terms of futures, maybe it will progress. People are so worried about the future in terms of their future safety, their future future job markets that are gonna, you know, pop up and all that. Is it gonna you know, help that carry that forward more quickly, or is it gonna kind of thwart the efforts of, you know, social entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs in general? I mean, I'm not really quite sure.
Well, I think that. I feel bad that I can't remember if it was John Smart or Ray Kurzweil who graphed out technological development. I guess it was Kurzweil because it was the law of accelerating returns, and showed that it was pretty much immune to financial turmoil. I mean, it's immune to plagues and to world wars and to any number of things that on an individual or even societal level we view as absolutely catastrophic or cataclysmic. And yet the progress from one technological development to the next seems to continue. So
it's almost as if the universe has taken that into account. Go ahead.
I mean, I love thinking about that stuff. I mean, a lot of the talk recently, just because of the whole economic situation, has centered on punctuated equilibrium, and it seems like socially we may be lurching, and opening windows for different types of development, but underneath it all, our information and technology, processes are just, it seems like they're on a smooth curve. To disrupt that would be very difficult. I mean, there's no shortage of innovation that's going on right now. There's a lot of new players getting into the field, and, it's probably a good thing that, the behemoths and the dinosaurs like the newspaper industry and all these other entrenched organizations that typically, make it part of their business model to counter innovation are losing their grip on something. So, from one standpoint, we might actually see a spurt of growth out of this rather than, any kind of slowdown.
Yeah, it could be that the good times allow for just flat out new development and creation, and then the bad times allow for some much needed creative destruction, both of which you have to have probably to maintain that. Once you have the right level of granularity, that kind of smooth curve going up. So does that help, Marissa? Have we cheered you up on the economy?
Yes, very much so.
It'll be more helpful when we can paint that into a tunnel of time and show, okay, here's the next period of creative destruction and, social chaos.
Right. Well, I actually want to get into the subway and punch in a destination and then go to that. It's like a Second Life kind of. I want to actually experience the kind of virtual reality, I guess, tunnel of time. That's probably sometime after 2013. Then you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's one that people are going to be cobbling together in 2016, 17. I think having had the privilege to talk to Philip Rosedale and some of the guys at Second Life in the early days, they really expect that to come online by about 2013 to be a serious competitor in the browser market. So once that becomes browser enabled, that instead of using Firefox, you're using Second Life or Firefox/Second Life. And the stuff you see can be all can be viewed at different levels of depth. The web interface itself could be 3D, and then you can also hop into these little windows instead of having your JPEGs. I mean, I think right there you're going to have the perfect storm. Quantitative search coming online, better Google search, awesome timelining by that point, and then stuff that can composite into 3D. I mean, that will be possible.
It's great that we're putting these dates out here, 2013, 2016. It's all being recorded. It's all going to be on the web. Google will be listening to this podcast at some point and holding us accountable to this. So we're all on the record with our predictions here. Well, we're well past our time. It went by so fast. I have to say that once in a while we have guests on that it feels more like just sitting around and chatting with friends than it does putting on a radio show, and that's exactly what it's like with the both of you. Thank you both, Alvis and Marissa, so much for being with us this evening, and I hope that we'll be able to have you on again very soon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Call us back whenever you'd like us. We're huge fans of the show. Memebox is, a diehard supporter of The Speculist. And we're going to look forward to tuning into whatever you guys have going in the next coming weeks.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. And the diehard support is absolutely mutual. Everyone listening, be sure and drop by memebox.com. Of course, we'll be linking that in our show notes. All right, Stephen, let's move on. And what's our music this evening?
Well, the band is named Underwhelmed. That doesn't describe either our show or the band. That's a pretty good band. And the song is Freak. So I thought it was pretty interesting. So let's give it a listen.
All right, so the song is Freak. The band is Underwhelmed. Stephen, thank you so much for being part of the program tonight. Michael, as always, a pleasure. To everyone in our chat room, thanks for your contributions this evening, everyone listening live, and to everyone listening to us recording. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio, and we look forward to being with you again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
Are you a freak like me?